Choose life. Choose a YouTube channel. Choose a channel name. Choose a video genre. Choose a fucking big video to make. Choose Adobe Premiere Pro, Audition, After Effects, and Photoshop. Choose an overpriced microphone, a mic holder, and good sound quality. Choose YouTube Shorts. Choose Fortnite. Choose your people to Twitch stream with. Choose Overwatch and Marvel Rivals. Choose to make passionate videos, only to switch to far-right grifting cringe clickbait, because it gets way more attention and ad revenue than anything you'll ever want to fucking make. Choose Talk Tua with Haley Welch, and wonder who the fuck would be stupid enough to buy her rug pull scam coin. Choose sitting on the couch, watching another soulless piece of entertainment made by or using AI, stuffing your face with over-caffeinated Prime and moldy cheese lunchly into your mouth. Choose rotting away knowing that while you struggle every day to find purpose, embarrassments like Johnny Somalia and Jack Dougherty earn millions of views and dollars doing nothing but inspire the next generation of fucked up brats to cause even further damage, hate, and chaos to the world for clout and clicks. Choose your low attention span. Choose life. But why would I want a thing like that? I choose not to choose life. I choose something else. And the reasons? There are no reasons. Who needs reasons when you've got Hate to Interrupt podcast?
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, that was fucking awesome.
I thought you hated us, LC Punk.
I'm hello there from Star Wars.
I'm VHS guy Nick.
I'm Gulif. I'm Ethan from Gulif.
I'm Culture Nick. I'm Nick from Stop Culture. That was great, Tim. I love that.
I texted you guys. I had an epic intro, but you guys had
you
no
didn't
idea.
Disappoint.
That's
yeah,
good.
That's yeah, so good. If you couldn't tell, we're covering Train Spotting today. Both Train Spotting.
We're covering Train Spotting and Terminator 2.
Terminator, yeah, directed by James Cameron. The second
the
one was made by James Cameron for some reason.
Why the fuck did he call it T2?
I really don't
know. I think maybe that was like the thing at the time. Maybe it was like a...
It was just 2017, you know?
Yeah, I think even at the time when it was coming out, people were like, why'd you do that, Danny? Danny Boyd?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm really not sure.
It is what it is.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're talking, how do we all feel about Trainspotting Uno?
Well,
this was Culture Nick. This is your recommendation, right?
Yeah, yeah. Before we get into the film,
yeah.
Did all of you guys watch? I think Nick watched this beforehand, but it was for Ethan.
This is the first time I've watched it and actually paid attention to it. I'll say that.
Oh, okay. So this is
my first watch.
And you too.
Yeah, this was my first time watching it, but it's been on my watch list for a while because a lot of Danny Boyle stuff has just been on my watch list for a while. I still haven't seen Slumdog Millionaire or 28 Days Later. Sorry, 127 Hours. That's what I meant. I've already seen 28 Days Later. But yeah, I think this is my favorite Danny Boyle film so far. This was really amazing. I texted this in the group chat the other day, and I was like, this is like SLC Punk if it wasn't written and directed by a 12-year-old. If it was actually made with actual craft and finesse and had an actual point to make it, that wasn't just cringe Reddit shit, the movie.
God damn. You really fucking hate that movie.
When we did the
I actually
SLC
hate
Punk.
It more. I actually hate it more now that I've seen this film, because I knew going in that, oh, it's just very heavily inspired by Trainspotting, but I hadn't seen the movie beforehand, so that didn't really matter to me. But now that I've seen the film, it is less inspired by and more just shitty derivative. I think that is a more appropriate way of describing SLC Punk, because it takes legitimately everything from this film. Like, there's even a character in SLC Punk that I remember that's just Spud, but less interesting and less of a fucking loser. Or, sorry, more of a loser. That's what I meant.
Heroin Bob.
No, are you talking about the guy who takes LSD and he thinks his front lawn is like a ocean or something?
He like tries to stab his mom.
Yeah,
I don't necessarily. I think it's derivative. I'm not gonna like disagree there, but I don't think the movie like is exactly the same at all. Like, I mean, I think the focus is entirely different. The focus of this film is about like addiction, and the focus of the other movie is about like whether
it's
punk is
culture,
like actually sick or not. So I mean,
yeah,
they're
completely
different concepts.
Yeah. Definitely similar, like, aesthetics and vibes.
Yeah, very similar aesthetic and vibes.
Yeah, aesthetically, they're
sure,
similar.
Yeah.
And they're definitely both trying to probe into the, you know, each specific respective counterculture that they're hitting on, you know?
So, yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Punk culture and then scumbag
so why,
drug addict culture.
Why do you recommend it? What made you want to recommend it?
Well, I've been meaning to make a video about Trainspotting 2 in particular for a long time, just because I think it's it does everything that a legacy like the best of what a legacy sequel should do. I think Trainspotting 2 does. I guess if you wanted to, you could accuse it of being heavy on member berries and stuff, although I think that's kind of baked into the concept of what the movie's trying to do. It's a movie basically about nostalgia addiction. Renton and his friends, they're kind of like replacing their heroin addiction. Sorry, guys.
You're good.
They're trying to replace their heroin addiction with something, and then nostalgia seems like the only thing that can really match what they were once addicted to, these like hard drugs that they can't really escape. So yeah. They kind of have to really, you know, keep driving home the remember wins. That's kind of what the movie's about. But I love Trainspotting 2. Trainspotting the first one was definitely like a seminal movie for me when I was younger, you know.
For me, this like Trainspotting 1 was that movie. Like I had a bunch of like when I grew up I had a bunch of like druggy friends. I was never like the person that did drugs, but all my friends did drugs. And this was like one of those movies that they always threw on and they like saw it as like iconic and shit, and like I just never like got into it. I always just kind of saw this movie like on in the room and I thought it was really cringy, so I never paid attention. And like I went back and watched it this time and I like it more than I thought I would the first one, but I still didn't like it all that much, if I'm being honest.
What do you think what did you think was cringy about it?
I just thought that what was like what people like, it's kind of like how people think Fight Club is lame because it's about like dudes being edgy and thinking they're sick. It's kind of like that for me with drugs, like in my mind. I'm not saying it's actually like that, but that was how I saw it and why I never really gave it a chance. Which yeah. I gave it a chance this time and I did enjoy it, but I wouldn't say it's like I don't like it as much as Timmy did. But I will. Well, we'll get into T2. But I liked it a lot more than I liked T1.
Well, you say as it like you didn't like it as me, but I think Ethan liked it the most out of all of us because I quite enjoyed it. I really loved it. I thought it was great as well. I did have like a couple issues with the film overall, but you know they're like kind of minor things that I can forgive because there was a lot that I really admire about the film, especially like from a filmmaking perspective. Because there's so much. I think that's the biggest thing about why I love this, but I hate SLC Punk, because SLC Punk is just the most indie Sundance bullshit ever, where you like their idea of cinematography is just put camera in front of people and then shoot and then we're done for the day. But in this, like, there's so much more interesting and creative cinematography at work. Like, obviously, the first instance that I can think of is, you know, when he goes to the worst toilet in all of Scotland or some shit, and it comes, you know, it essentially becomes more of like a surrealist piece. It enters into this more trippy environment where he's actually kind of going inside the toilet and it becomes this, you know, this swimming scene, this like water world-esque aesthetic where it's essentially just like on a surface level aesthetic, it looks great. Like it's so creative of essentially just showing a guy getting suppositories out of a shit toilet. But the way that it's presented and how it's being portrayed in Ewan McGregor's character's mind, like it's as if it's this big feat of accomplishment to get suppositories to swim down below and then say, fucking brilliant, or whatever he said in the film. It's like it's really creative. And then obviously you have the more like iconic scenes, like the withdrawal scene where he's in the bedroom and the bed he's in is like this fucking claustrophobic nightmare where shit just randomly starts popping up, like how Begbie just randomly shows up to him next in bed and he's like squirming around and then suddenly he's gone. And then obviously when the baby is crawling like at the ceiling of the room and Ewan McGregor's character's just screaming, he's like, no, 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 please, no. It's really nightmarish. It's like some fucking David Lynch, Satoshi Kon-esque shit going on. And I really appreciate it. But I love how the film, it's not all that. Like, that's not very representative of the film. Like, those are moments that are introduced throughout the film. It's, like, blocked at certain moments. Because the rest of the film is pretty normal. It's just characters, you know, doing drugs, taking heroin, all that stuff. But I love how when they do heroin, it's portrayed in a way that we can conceptualize and we can understand from their perspective, because, you know, I've never done heroin before, obviously, so I wouldn't know what that's like. But I love how the film presents that in a way that makes sense to me as an audience member, and presents in a way where, oh, I sort of get this, you know. And that's especially the case with the music as well, which is fucking awesome. But I love how the music choices in particular really add to a lot of those trippy sequences, because that's a lot of positive music for essentially really fucked up moments, you know, like when Ewan McGregor gets so high that he like falls into the carpet and he's dragged to the hospital, and they play fucking Perfect Days like in the background. Like, it's really fucked up, but they play this really positive music along with those scenes to showcase from Ewan McGregor's mind. It's not, I mean, it is fucked up, but he likes it. It's a positive thing in his mind, because he'd rather be high than, like he said, choosing life, facing reality and all that shit. It's really just great filmmaking from Danny Boyle.
Yeah, I mean, Trainspotting for me was it's always been one of the best drug movies to me, because too often I think drug movies fall into like one of two categories, where they either romanticize drugs or the drug lifestyle, or they demonize it and just they don't really, you know, they don't portray it as something believable for people who aren't involved in the lifestyle at all to understand why someone would, quote unquote, like throw their life away by engaging in, you know, addictive behaviors, especially with something like heroin. But I mean, it's right from like the first 10 minutes of the movie, Ewan McGregor's voiceover is talking about, like, you know, it's really again. Well, it's not that. It's like it's really fucking good. Like, that's why we do it, because it's really fucking good. We're going to show you how good it looks and feels to be high, but we're also going to show you the lows, which comes, you know, obviously with like the terrible thing that happens to the baby, and then the withdrawal scene.
That was fucked up.
Yeah.
And the friend character. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tommy too.
Tommy. That's right. Yeah. And yeah, all- this no, go ahead, Nick.
No, you go ahead. Your turn.
No, this first one, it had that like really nice kind of just grungy quality to it that I really loved. Like, this was so disgusting. particularly the scene where Spud shits himself in the bed, and then he brings the sheets out and flings it all over them while they're eating fucking beans and toast or whatever British people eat. I was like watching this in bed, and I like wanted to gag. Like, that was so disgusting. This was like, what, 10, 15 minutes after the whole toilet scene, which was also disgusting. Like, this is the most fucking foul movie. Yeah.
And isn't it so funny?
You don't
how
like
they,
a little poopy?
They make the Scottish cuisine look almost as disgusting as the shit that's, that's in all of his fucking sheets.
Oh, yeah, Scottish, not British. Sorry.
Yeah.
I think that's why, like, the movie just didn't hit for me. It's not that there's anything innately wrong with the film. Like, the only thing, like, that I would say is, like, actually, like, I didn't like about the movie is I think there was some really weird editing choices. I don't think the filmmaking itself had any kind of issues, but I definitely think there were some weird parts of the edit that just made it look its age and feel kind of janky.
Well, I feel like that was intentional, though. Like, the editing, like, the janky, like, chaotic editing, like, was very intentional.
I'm talking about
the
chaotic cutting away, because
like
obviously
the freeze
like,
frame portions?
Like, a lot of the time, whenever, like, there was, like, a lot of action, like, whenever, like, in the bar scenes and stuff like that, it was just weird cuts and angle choices, and I was just like, why are they, whatever. But, like, other than that, I mean, it was really just that drug stuff makes me kind of feel uncomfortable, is really why I didn't like the first movie as much. And just some of the scenes just were, like, just kind of icky for me to watch, and I think that's probably intentional. So maybe the movie's doing its job and it just isn't
it's 100% intentional. You're supposed to be uncomfortable when you see those things. Like, I get what you're saying, where it's like, oh, you feel uncomfortable and that's why you don't like it. I think that is a perfect reason of why you don't connect with something. I don't care as much about that. I'm just in it for good filmmaking. I'm in it to watch good movies, and it's a lot of great filmmaking, and, you know, I can't help but admire it's just terrible shit happening, you know. Like, I couldn't help but think about that scene where Sick Boy's wife or girlfriend or whatever, she just starts wailing, she starts screaming, and at first you're just like, what the fuck is going on? And then you see the dead baby, and I love how they actually show the dead baby. Like, they don't pussy out or like cut away or like show like its feet or some shit. Like, they actually show like the disfigured baby in the crib to really just sell like just how just terrible this is and how much they fucked up as junkies. Like, they're, you know, and it's not like they were hiding this either. It wasn't exactly like a twist or anything, because we saw in the beginning the baby just roaming around, crawling around.
Yeah, there's a lot of setup for it. You can see, as soon as I saw that baby, and I was like, that baby's gonna die or something. It's got bad scam with this
that
baby.
That baby's fucked.
Then they have it immediately lead into her, like, all right, well, I need another hit.
I need a hit.
Like, just like, as soon as they find the baby, just like, well, I gotta forget this. Super sad. Like,
me
it's
first.
Depressing.
Yeah, but you don't even blame them for doing that. You don't even blame them for having that mindset. Yeah, because,
literally their entire life is not facing their problems.
Yeah.
So, like, they need heroin to cope with their the shittiness of life. You know, this is just another thing they have to cope with now, using heroin. And I love how Ewan McGregor is like, oh yeah, go ahead, sorry.
One thing I'll say is Robert Carlyle is such a fucking sick actor, bro. Like,
he's really good.
No,
he's
Bigby.
Oh, he's Bigby. Oh.
He's so goddamn good in everything. Have y'all seen the full Monty?
No.
Oh, it's so fucking good. I love him so much.
I've only ever seen him in Once Upon a Time. My wife made me watch that show, and he's like the main villain in it.
Oh yeah, he's
great.
His name?
He's Rumpelstiltskin.
Rumpelstiltskin.
Jesus.
He really shines.
Yeah, he's great.
He was in 28 Weeks Later, right? I think that's the only thing I've seen Robert Carlyle in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Y'all should check out the full Monty. It's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another legacy sequel that Danny Boyle's doing again, right? The 28 Years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. But I feel like that has more of a purpose to. You know what? I'm gonna save that for when we talk about
Let's save that for.
I just can't emphasize how great the music is. Like, before I went into this film, all I've ever heard is, aside from, you know, all the other things we mentioned, is, oh, the soundtrack is really good. Like, the soundtrack, it's like the go-to classic vinyl record movie soundtrack that people put on. And I can totally see why, because not only are the songs themselves, like, really good, but they do a really great job of selling the tone, selling the emotions that the characters are going through. Like, I love how the film starts with that Iggy Pop song while they're running through, while they're getting chased by guards, you know, and then he gives the choose life speech. And normally I don't really care for voiceover narration. I'm very particular with things like that. Like, 90% of the time I get really annoyed by that, and I would just prefer show don't tell, like visual metaphor, like imagery type shit. You know, the only other time that I feel like that's appropriate, if it's like a Martin Scorsese film or something. But it's actually used very, very well in this one. It's a combination of show and tell. You know, like Goodfellas, like Casino, like Wolf of Wall Street, you know, like any other Scorsese film, where it's, you know, it's Retton's way, Mark's way of, you know, introducing us to this world, you know, getting us to know the characters, the people that he's friends with, and, you know, his mindset. But it's also a way of, like, communicating how he feels emotionally. Like, I love towards the, like, the last act of the movie where he just straight up leaves Scotland, he moves to London, and finally, like, gets his shit together. He finally tries to start clean, start fresh, you know, and he's starting to get his life together. He's starting to you know, make some money, but
choose
then
life.
these guys just weasel their way back into his lives. They start sucking him dry. They start stealing his shit and pawning off his shit for fish and chips. And you can feel the frustration in Ewan McGregor's narration, where he's like, I have to get rid of these guys. These guys are fucking stealing all my shit. Like, they're clawing me back in. And it's really great. I really do like the narration in this. Sometimes it got a little annoying, in the sense that there were some parts where things were being perfectly understandable, and yet there was still narration going on. And I was like, okay, I understand, but we don't need this here. There were parts, I didn't feel that way all the time, but there were parts where I was just like, all right, movie, that's enough.
And you must have loved the Clockwork Orange, you know, visual callbacks, you know, like when they're in the bar in the beginning, they have like the Maloka milk bar shit, you know?
Yeah, really cool. I think Danny Boyle said a lot of the characters were inspired by, like, Alec. I think he said Mark is like partially inspired by Alex from A Clockwork Orange. So I definitely got a lot of Clockwork Orange vibes from the film, obviously from the visual side, like you said. But yeah, maybe that's why I like the movie, because it's so much like my favorite movie ever.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the soundtrack of this movie being iconic, which it totally is. I mean, I always kind of felt like, growing, I was born in 93, so I was like 3 years old when this movie came out. Obviously, I didn't see it. I saw, which I feel like these two movies are very different. So I don't know if you guys are going to totally catch my drift here, but if The Matrix defined what 90s cool was for Americans, this movie defined what 90s cool was for people in the UK. And that's everything from just the aesthetic of the movie, like how fucking, you know, how awesome it looks, and then how, what it sounds like, and what all, totally, you know, what all the characters like, yeah, look like. And then, you know, it's very hard to compare them. They're totally different movies. But you can watch The Matrix when you're a kid, so I didn't really catch up with this movie until I was like later.
Yeah, this isn't a kid's movie.
Yeah. But
throw this on in front of a 7-year-old. Check this out, buddy. This is what heroin feels like.
Mm-hmm. No, there's something about the way they depict like the actual intravenous drug use in this that's like, it's very disconcerting, because it's like, it's clear that they're having the best fucking time ever, but it's just like watching somebody feel that good, there's almost something kind of sinister about it. So it kind of makes it,
like,
look
wrong.
Away.
Yeah,
it looks like kind of disgusting almost, you know, watch. And then that's with all like tourniquets and the fucking, you know, the blood. The way that that's all shot too, especially during the scene when he ODs and, you know, like Tim mentioned with the carpet and everything, it's just like, it's very, very difficult to watch, especially because like, I think I've told some of you guys this, I don't know if you all know, but I was a heroin addict previously in my life, like my early 20s. I was an addict, so I like watching, that's why Trainspotting 2, and we'll get to that, but that's why that movie means so much to me, because it's more about like trying to move on, like to pick up the pieces after you are like in the throes of active addiction, and then just like what to do with your life afterwards, like trying to get yourself addicted to something that's not going to fucking kill you or ruin your life and devastate all your relationships, you know? So that movie really means a lot to me, because there's not that many movies about that topic. Most drug movies are, like I was saying before, it's like, you know, you're going to do it, you're going to fucking kill yourself, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's either the romanticization.
It's like fear preaching.
Yeah, romanticization, yeah, or just making it look like the worst thing in the world. But Trainspotting 2 really shows you, like, what it's like for people who don't die, who don't end up in jail or dead, like
how you can move forward,
yeah, how you recover, like the throes of that process, which is very difficult as well.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for sharing. Yeah, I'm glad. Thank you for being open about that.
No problem.
Yeah, so
that's really good to have your perspective on this. That's like very insightful. So
would you say then, like, that the way that they portray heroin addicts in this film is maybe not 100% accurate, but at least like accurate enough where like it reflects people who have done stuff like this in the past? Because my understanding and kind of how I view people who take substances like these are, like you said, like I fucking hate when drug movies like this go two ways. Like, they either over romanticize it or they just make it the worst fucking shit out. Like, it's like Reefer Madness or some shit like that. Mm-hmm. But I've always had this understanding that the people who take these sort of things, they don't do it because they think they're cool or because they just, something like that. They do it because they don't have anything else in their lives. You know, they're going through an extremely rough patch. They're having these extreme issues of depression and self-hatred and suicidal tendencies where, you know, life has beaten them down and they don't have any other way to cope. And they kind of need to depend on, you know, in this case, heroin it's why that Choose Life speech that Ewan McGregor's character says in the beginning is so impactful, because it's so nihilistic. You know, he's just, I am so beaten down and I'm so fucking tired and exhausted with life and kind of everything that it means to be a person in the average everyday life that I'd rather just be high all the time on heroin as a way of coping with that than just dealing with all that bullshit. So as a long question, would you say, is that an accurate way of looking at the film, or like an accurate way of what the film is trying to communicate?
Yeah, I mean, I think this movie, there's a million different ways that you can find yourself addicted to heroin or opioids or you know, or anything like that. Like, some people find their way into it on accident, where it's just like, that's why they call it the opioid epidemic, because it's like, we overprescribe painkillers. Those people got addicted to painkillers. They couldn't afford the painkillers anymore. And then they started doing heroin. So it's like, you know, that's one way where it's more of like a, you know, partying gone wrong sort of thing. But then some people, which I feel like I'd honestly like fall more into the second camp, where it's like, yes, you're extremely depressed. You're looking for something in your life that can make you feel a little bit better for a little bit of the time, you know? And it's like, since it drops you with these characters, right, they're in active addiction from the very beginning, you don't really know what brought them to that place. I mean, you can kind of make some assumptions about some of them, but like, I don't know, it doesn't really say one way or the other whether they were all like extremely depressed and then they started looking for that as a coping mechanism or what. But just in terms of the way it depicts the struggle, like the grind of actually having a heavy addiction, where you have to fund it, you have to figure out where you're going to get it, you have to not be sick. In order to do anything in your life, you have to have it, because if you don't have it, you get the fucking the bedroom scene with the train and the fucking baby on. You know, that's obviously a dramatization, yeah. But like, it is that bad. You
but
know?
I'm sure, like, it feels like that is bad. You know?
It's really, it's fucking horrible. You know,
I have a question. So whenever he was going through withdrawals at his family's, they were like, "No, you're not going to fucking rehab. You're staying here." Why didn't they want him to go to rehab? Were they just afraid he's going to like escape or something?
Well, he was, right before he overdoses, he was going to the methadone clinic, and methadone is an opioid maintenance drug. So what they'll do is, I don't know how it works in Edinburgh, especially at that time in Edinburgh, but it seemed like he was going to an outpatient program. So he wasn't like stuck there, you know, maybe they had places like that. Maybe they didn't, maybe they couldn't afford it. I don't know, but he wanted to go to the methadone clinic so he could just, he wouldn't get high from taking methadone at that point. But he would
just controls your symptoms.
Yeah. It would make his withdrawals go away. And then he's like, asking his mom for, remember, he's like, give us some jellies. Like that's for benzodiazepines, like Xanax you could take to alleviate the symptoms of opioid withdrawal. So he's like, just give me fucking something to help this. And they're like, no, like, you're gonna just like sit in this room, because we can't, because they couldn't trust him at that point, which is at the point every parent or everyone who's like in a relationship with someone like that, you'll get to a point with that person where you can't trust them anymore, because they're literally just not trustworthy, you know? They're going to fuck up, because they can't trust themselves, you know? They care about the drug more than anything.
Yeah, and I love how it's like a natural conclusion to that as well, because Ewan McGregor's character, he states multiple times, okay, this is it. I'm going to get off heroin once and for all. I'm going to stop now. Like, and that's literally how the film begins. He's like, this is the last time. I'm not going to do heroin anymore. And the guy just responds saying, yeah, I've heard that before. I've heard that multiple times. But he also has this mentality where he's just, okay, I just need to get high one more time. I just need to do it one more time. And then I can use that to cope, to get through my withdrawal so that I can be done with this. But, you know, then it just puts him in this cycle where he says he's going to stop, but then he's also going to do one more to help him to stop, only for him to do heroin again. And so it makes sense, like, why. And I love how, like, the parents aren't portrayed, like, the parents aren't like Jesse's parents from Breaking Bad, where they just ostracize him. They just fucking kick him out and then treat him like shit. You know, like, they're actually loving people. So when they decide to lock him up, it's less just them being a dick and more just, look, we're doing this for your own good. Like, we've given you multiple chances. You've had multiple chances to stop doing this, but you failed every single time. So we're going to do some tough love. This is what we're going to do, because this is the only way we're going to get you to stop. And eventually it does, because that transitions to the next scene where he moves to London. He starts finally getting his life back together. He has his own apartment. He has a job. You know, he's making enough income to live reasonably, not shittily, you know, like, it's so it must have worked at the end. I mean, I don't know if that is like a end all cure all of things, because again, I'm I've never really done anything like this before, but it makes sense within the context of this is what Ewan McGregor's character needed to finally break the cycle, to finally start clean. Because I love how in the beginning when he tried, and this also goes to show that this film, just as much as it is about addiction, it's also about, you know, toxic friends, like being stuck with a toxic group of people who just love to enable you to do all this shitty stuff. Like they want nothing more for you to feel like shit, because they already feel like shit and they want everyone to be on the same level. Where Sick Boy, he quits heroin not because he wants to, but he just does it to fuck with Ewan McGregor's character. It's like, yeah, just out of spite. It's just like, look, it's so easy, see, I'm doing it, and you're making it sound like a tough thing, but I can do it, I can easily do it. You know, and then you have Begbie, who's not even doing heroin. But love how.
Yeah, I was going to ask: does he at all do it in this movie? Or no,
he doesn't. But he and himself is a victim of addiction as well. He's just addicted to something else, and his addiction is violent.
Adrenaline.
Adrenaline. He just loves beating the shit out of people. He loves causing chaos. He loves starting bar fights and whacking people with pole sticks for chewing for daring to open a bag of potato chips and chewing them slightly louder than he'd like. Yeah. You know, the guy just thrives on chaos.
He's a fucking super
villain.
That's
his addiction.
I like that they gave him like a chance of redemption in the second film too, and
he did not take it.
Yeah.
No.
Well, to jump ahead to the second one first. I don't want to finish up the first one conversation yet, but to jump ahead to the second one real quick, when he's like hugging Mark's body while he's hanging there, he's like, Mark,
it's all right.
Yeah, it's almost over.
It's almost over.
It was kind of sweet in a weird fucking sociopathic way.
Yeah. I love the whole, that perfect sequence. It was like at the very beginning where they're still introducing characters. You just get that freeze from him throwing the glass in the middle of the air, and then it just shatters, runs down. Like, I don't remember what he said. All right, someone hit this quantum until we find the fucking quantum. And then he's like, who are you? And he just punches.
I wish they would have realized how good of a character Spud was before the second movie. I feel like he was really underutilized in the first film.
Actually, an interesting thing about Ewan, his name, because Spud's character's name is Ewan Bremner. And the actor who plays him.
Yeah.
Before Trainspotting was made into a movie, first it was a book, but then it was a stage play in London, I think. And he actually played Renton. He was the main
character.
That's
interesting. Yeah.
Initially, but then when it went Hollywood, they're like, all right, we got to get a hot guy. Like,
we got to get a super handsome fella.
Yeah, we got
to
get
a new Ewan.
Well, yeah. I don't even think it's that, because Ewan McGregor wasn't very big at the time. I think this was only his fourth film, I think. He only got the job because he was in Danny Boyle's previous film, Shallow Grave, I think it was called, which I haven't seen. It's been on my watch list for a while, but
he's a handsome guy.
Because he's hot.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, he's a lot more handsome than the fucking
He's really good, but he's really good in the movie, Ewan McGregor. Like, he fits the role very well. Like, he lost so much weight and he shaved his head to play the part. He's very good in the film. Everyone's really good, but Ewan McGregor in particular, I think, was probably the best actor in the film.
Ewan McGregor was.
Yeah, he was really good.
Oh yeah.
He wears those like slutty shirts the whole movie.
Yeah.
the his like mid rifts and like the tiny little sleeves. I guarantee it's because he just like stole those from like a kid's like clothesline or something.
Yeah.
I think that's such a funny character, like
when
costume design.
When he first meets Kelly McDonald, like the young girl at the Corova Milk Bar place. Yeah, and he's literally wearing like a 12-year-old girl's shirt. I liked her character too, because like she's kind of interesting, because they show her probably having at least a bit more money than any one of the main characters. She has like really good parents, like really cool parents, so she's like her interaction with these guys, she's kind of like dipping a toe into the wild side, you know, by hanging out with them.
Yeah.
But she's never, and that's what, you know, in Trainspotting too, you see, like, she was never really, and she was never meant to end up like them. Like, she's a lawyer, she's doing great, and she's like, are you still doing
heroin, Mark? She's just experimenting.
Are you fucking this child that you just brought into my into my fucking office?
I will say that's, like, one thing I didn't like about the movie. I thought the whole him fucking a 15-year-old was just completely pointless. It's less I'm throwing a hissy fit that he EDP'd girl.
Okay.
It's more just like, I don't see what the point is of including this in the film. Like, I didn't really understand why she was necessary in the, like, she's one of the five people on the fucking poster, and yet I didn't understand what her role was in the film. Like, she showed up like maybe three times throughout the film, and then she was
she's basically in the end is like the grand decider of who's a good person and who's worthy of this money. That's basically all it is. But like, I also think that it kind of makes sense considering like Ewan McGregor's character just lost his family or lost his wife. He's going through basically a midlife crisis. He's like being drugged back into this weird life. Like, it kind of makes sense that he just makes shitty choices like that.
Oh wait, no, we're talking about
the first one.
No, we're talking about the first one. Yeah.
The second one with Veronica. Oh, we're talking about the first movie with Diane. Okay. The school
yeah,
role.
No, I was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he's an idiot in the first movie. Like, I feel like it makes sense.
Well, yeah, we should.
I mean, either way, I don't really know what her, like, okay, cool. The point was he EDP'd a 15-year-old. Okay, cool. Great. Fantastic. That was a real knee slapper. That was hilarious. But is that really it? Is that why? Because, like,
I don't know if it's
really
supposed to be funny.
Doesn't have.
Also, I'm pretty sure, like, the age of consent there is, like, 15, by the way.
I don't think so.
Well, he's definitely he's concerned about going to jail over it.
Yeah, so like, I don't.
I think it's pretty low there, bro.
Kelly McDonald. Diane
in 1920, it was 16, so, and she was 15, so yeah, no.
She clearly didn't doctor
like
disrespect.
No, I think it's just more of like
consent.
To show you, like, I don't
it's
know.
16 in the UK.
Yeah, I think it's more just like, just another one of those things where it's like, look, these people aren't particularly good people. They're not smart people. They're very flawed, and everything's messy and kind of fucked up. I mean, it's another crime that he just adds to his list of things he did, intentionally or not, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that she's just like, well, if you don't call me back, I'm going to fucking report you. That was funny.
Do you guys want to move over to the second one now at this point? Anyone?
I have more to say about
the
second one probably anyways. So.
Okay. Yeah,
that's interesting because I have significantly less to say about the second one, but we can get into it. Yeah,
what's your take?
So
on
Arnold Schwarzenegger returns in Terminator 2: Judgment Day.
No. Very interesting that they swapped out Linda Hamilton with Ewan McGregor in this one. Very very interesting
very
choice.
Weird.
Yeah, this one was fine. It was okay. It wasn't like bad, but I guess like my main issue with the film while I was watching it was just I don't understand why this exists, like why this movie needed to happen. Like, I mean, obviously Nick has his personal connection with this film and the story that it's trying to tell, and I can't really take away that from him. But for me personally, just like watching this as a sequel to Trainspotting. I just sat there and I was like, this movie isn't justifying its existence. Like, I don't understand why this movie exists. Like, it's fine. It's like decent. How I feel about this film is pretty much the same as how I feel about like 60% of the legacy sequels that have come out forever for the past 10 to 15 years. You know, it's like the same vein as like, I don't know, Top Gun, Maverick or Tron Legacy or some shit where it's just, this is nice. This is fun. This is entertaining. Like, I wasn't bored watching this. Like, maybe the first 30 minutes were really boring. I was just, like, kind of waiting to see where things were going because it didn't feel like things were progressing. It was entertaining, but my main thought was just, I don't understand why this exists. Like, why this movie needed to happen other than just, isn't it crazy that...
Well, I don't think it's like the first film. It's not like the first film ended on a cliffhanger and it needed to happen. But I also think the first film was basically like an ensemble film with no like meaningful conclusion for any of the other characters. It literally only basically filled up like ended like the situation for one character.
I disagree. Like the first Trainspotting film is very much Mark's character. That's his film. But now that he's not even the main character in his own sequel anymore, it's just this ensemble cast, which, like, conceptually sounds interesting. But because we don't have a central character to focus our attention on, then, like, the whole film just kind of is meanders for 2 hours. It's just we're moving from point A to point B from different plot points. And, you know, each individual plot point is conceptually interesting, but the whole time I was like, what's the point? Like, I don't really see what the greater point of all this is.
I mean, you know? I mean, what's the point of the first movie?
My biggest issue with two, although I do love it, it's a really, really special movie to me. My biggest issue is the entire film hinges on the fact that you have to just believe that Mark Renton stealing that money from those guys, you know, whatever it was, like 22 years ago, still means so much to them. And they're like, especially for Begbie, like it has to be the thing that Begbie looks back on in his life, like everything. And even though this is clearly wrong and he's just a fucking psychopath, but like you need to believe that he thinks that his life was ruined when Mark did that. And so does, and Sick Boy as well. So like, is that, I think that makes sense.
They set it up in a way that makes sense. 'Cause he was in jail for 20 years, you know? I mean,
yeah, but like, it's $4,000 in 1996, and now it's 21 years later.
Probably would have been like $9,000, something like
but
that.
But basically,
now.
He just inflation. Had all that time, inflation all that time in jail to just think about fucking how everybody who's ever wronged him. And that might have been the most recent person who wronged him, you know?
Yeah, like it makes sense why Begbie would still give a shit. You know, that makes sense. And I think that was the most interesting thing about the film. But then they try to do the same with Spud and Sick Boy, but then they just immediately forget about it like 20 minutes after they introduced it. So I was like, oh, okay, so I guess this just didn't matter because they're now just back to... Because I get what you're saying. It's about like Mark trying his best to cut himself off from this toxic group. But now that he's like pretty much lost, at least he claims he's lost everything because his wife divorced him and he's losing his job. You know, he's just, I don't have anything better to do. So I'll just slide back into, you know, this group I once tried to cut off from. And I'm starting this brothel scheme with Sick Boy. And that's cool. But, you know, I guess I wasn't really emotionally connecting with anything in the film. I was way more attached with what was happening with the first film. And I felt like there was more of a hook. There was more of a point to what's being communicated. And in this one, it just felt like the band is back together and that's great. But there wasn't much else I was getting out of the film. It's not like it was poorly made or anything. I still like the way the film shot and I like how the film plays with color and to an extent the music. But I don't know. It just kind of feels less as good as the first film. Like the soundtrack isn't nearly as good as the soundtrack in the first film.
I think the soundtrack is great too in the second one. I really like it's good,
but like it's not.
I think the soundtrack's good, and the musical timing is better too. Like the way they time the music. Go on, Nick. Well, my only thing that I saw with it is like the visual effects shots were like they like some of them hit. But like the first ones were like way better whenever they were trying to like pull off like interesting shots. Some of them were just kind of like borderline cheesy in the second one.
Yeah, like when they're
playing, like which one?
When they're playing with
like whenever he's like writing in the wall with his hand and shit.
Oh yeah, that was stupid. Yeah, I was like, all right,
that was dumb. Danny, did you really need to do that?
And then in the end, when the room's like going along a big passageway,
I thought that was kind of fun. I liked
it. It was cool, like in concept, but it just looked really cheesy. Is my biggest thing.
There were some that I actually really loved,
mid-budget movie. Like, what are you gonna?
Well, I like some of them, like what they did with the shadow. Whenever he's like in the room,
that was really cool.
I liked the shadow shot, and that then was so cool. Specifically, I think I even just said out loud, I was like, oh wow, that's really cool. He's with his dad for the first time, and you see his mom's shadow on the wall. I thought that was beautiful,
and I love that. For me, it was like 50-50. Yeah, and I love that part where when Spud was trying to kill himself, they visually express that through the scene where he just
falls
out of his chair, falls off a building. But then at the last minute when Renton breaks through the door, he just catches him in that surrealist moment. I thought that was really cool. I quite liked that. Yeah.
There's a handful of really cool creative filmmaking moments in the second one.
Yeah.
But not as much as the first one, in my opinion, but yeah.
And then other moments were just like, Oh, did you find something on After Effects you really liked and you really wanted to express that? Good on you, Danny.
Well, I think one of my, in terms of visual effects, is my favorite sequence is when Sick Boy and Mark are like, it's right after they scam those 1690 weird Protestant people out of money, and they get back to his place, and they're like playing with fucking like face swapper effects on their phones, because like that to me
that
was kind of cute. It's like cringe. It's cringe in a way, but like these two guys in their mid 40s who haven't seen each other in 20 years, like of course they're gonna be like, oh, you see this fucking thing I got on my phone, you know, like they're gonna
look on where the cat is.
They're gonna be they're like Gen X dudes who are gonna be cringe online, and that, like, to me that's cool. Veronica's like, you know, you guys are just all you talk about is the past, you know, and of course they would, because they, you know, there's just so much time. It's all they know. They live in the past. That's what the movie's about. I thought like all the soccer stuff too was really cool, like when, you know, when there's like the shower is coming down.
Oh yeah, from, when they slide through.
Yeah, they do the slide, the, and then the it field, zooms out. Yeah, and, yeah, it
zooms out. You see their apartment. Yeah.
So one thing I want to know. So I know late, like, so one thing I really liked about the movie is that they didn't just completely like backpedal everybody to like fucking basically like they've regressed all of their positive traits that they've gained over the years.
Rebooting the first one.
Yeah. So like, I really liked that they didn't do that. And I was like, I really hope they don't fucking just make them fucking just start doing drugs again, because that's just going to be so fucking lame. And then at the end, fucking the main character, Rendon and fucking Sick Boy do heroin or whatever. But I'm pretty sure, am I crazy? That's like a metaphorical them taking heroin scene.
I don't think they actually did heroin. I think it was just. Did they? Okay.
Because the thing that fucked me up is like every single time in these films when they do heroin, they like really, really emphasize like the after effects of them doing the drug every single time. And they didn't. They had literally nothing in this movie. Like,
yeah, they just go to the next scene and just continue story.
There was no like repercussions, no nothing. So like, it felt like it was very much like metaphorical to that. Like, we have blood. We share blood. We share blood with each other. Like, yeah. But like, I could be wrong. But I genuinely don't know.
It could be. I never even considered that. I thought like from when they met up again. Once I saw that scene, I was like, well, it was obvious that it was going to happen at least once. It's a ticking time bomb. Like, they're back together. Renton's back in Edinburgh. He's like, you know, moved on with his life, but you can't really escape this kind of shit. Like, and his biggest issue with addiction was the fact that he couldn't get away from this toxic group of friends that really cared more about getting high with each other than they actually did about each other personally. So when they get back together, of course it's going to happen at least once. And they show Spud, like, cause Spud's still trying to be clean, but he's like terrified in the corner cause he wants to do it too. But, and he's watching them do it. I didn't think it was metaphorical. I think they actually,
I'm going to Google it. Cause
it.
I was going to wait to ask.
Yeah. I got the impression that it was metaphorical. Cause that's the only time that anyone actually does heroin in the film. So I didn't think it was literal. It was just more, an embodiment of the characters returning to their past lives, like their past friendship, and you know, their past friendship involved a lot of heroin, so that's how that was portrayed in that specific piece of imagery. I don't know, it could go either way. I got the impression that it was more metaphorical than literal, but who knows? I'm not 100% sure.
I think it was, if it is literal or metaphorical, but if it's like literal, I do have an issue with how they showed it, because it does feel kind of like, oh, let's throw in a shot where they do some heroin and then we just keep going. Like there wasn't really an effect. Like, you could cut that scene and everything would be the exact same. You know, I don't know. It just felt kind of inconsequential if that is literally what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I guess I could have taken or leaving it. I'm now that I'm thinking about it. I don't know. Nick, did you see whether or not it's supposed to be literal or metaphorical?
It seems like it's never really been answered. Some people think it is, some people think it isn't. So
it's up for interpretation.
They're saying in the book he does. They're saying in the book he doesn't, but also I don't know if that scene's even in the book.
I would like to, then I would kind of confirm that as then they didn't do it, because Irvine Welsh, the writer of the book and the squeakquel, Porno to Trainspotting. The book is called Porno. I'm not saying it's a porno. is like heavily involved in both of these films, and I think he's in the movie. I think he's in both movies now that I think about it. So I have to imagine that that's the correct answer, but I like leaving it up to interpretation where it could go either way. Either I guess the reason why I'm saying it's more metaphorical than literal, because I just can't imagine Ewan McGregor's character reverting back to doing heroin, you know, because he even says it himself, like, oh, I've been clean for 20 years. I haven't done it in 20 years. And he even has this speech to what was his name?
Spud.
That was it. Yeah. Spud. When they're hiking, and he's like, we're all addicts. You need to be addicted, but be addicted to something else. Be addicted
but
to something
else. Just because you understand how
to
like fight your addiction doesn't mean you're going to succeed every day. You know, I mean, it's possible he could, like, any addict could like break down any day. Right. I mean, that's just kind of how addiction works.
I guess it's possible that they
could have just done it that one time and it didn't happen again. I mean, that's possible, especially considering the fact that Renton, you know, he's not 21 anymore. Like he's a man. He's probably like, oh, I fucked up. I'm not going to do that again. Like that's believable that they were able to just like kind of indulge and just let it happen, especially because it really mirrors what happened in the first
but also
movie
the
when they're at the, they're, you know, in the field again. And then that's what brings it on, is they start thinking about all the bad times from their youth. They're like, oh, you fucking let that baby die. You got Tommy hooked on H. And then they're like, oh, fuck, I guess we got to do this.
The thing that also makes me feel like it didn't actually happen is like you said, like Spud's just cowering in the corner. Like they wouldn't, and he's like trying to like break his addiction. There's no way they would just do that shit right in front of him.
Of course they would.
Like, they are shitty.
They would. They 100% would. They're terrible.
Well, no, they're
people.
Shitty. They're shitty people, but they're not like. Ewan McGregor's character is not a fucking addict anymore. He would see that. That's probably like, I don't know. I just don't buy
I mean,
it.
if you're to the point where you're going to do it again, you're not going to care who you do it in front of, you know.
After 20 years, I feel like
I don't. And, I'm just saying, I like, I from well, addicts but, I've talked to, and you can chime in, Colter. Like, I feel like if you decide to make that decision to just start doing it again, like, oh well, it'll be fine. You kind of just don't care at that point. Like, once you start doing it again, you're like, it's fucked.
Yeah,
and you also have to remember that, like, Sick Boy in the first film went out of his way to spite Renton by like fucking with him for trying to get off heroin, to go clean. So like he's the last person I would expect to actually try and respect Spud's wishes of trying
well,
to
I don't think
break
about,
away
I don't
from
think
heroin.
Sick Boy would care, but I think Renton's character would care, because I think he, regardless of him not necessarily being the best person, I think he did care about Spud.
I mean, my favorite scene in the second one is the Choose Life scene, which is crazy that it is, because, Tim, you know, everyone knows that's the fucking most iconic scene from the first one. It's one of the most legendary movie scenes of the 90s, probably. And the fact that they were able to really hit that home and just show all the pain of the last 20 years of being middle-aged, of not realizing yourself, you know, self-actualization is basically... You know, he's not going to be able to achieve that in his life. And now the Choose Life speech is so much more depressing now, especially the part where he's like, choose never learning from your own mistakes. And, you know, choose the slow realization of what you can get versus what you always wanted. You know, like there's so many great lines in that little monologue that I just love so much. Nick, when I watched that, I thought of you. I was like, Nick definitely loves this shit too.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was one of the few, I guess you could call it a member berry, that I actually really liked and I thought actually fit what was good. Because what I love about the Choose Life speech in this one is that there's a completely different context for it now. Because when he did the Choose Life thing in the first film, both in the beginning of the movie and at the end of the movie, it was him kind of reconciling this cynical, nihilistic perspective he had on life and how he used heroin as a way of coping with that. So his doing the Choose Life thing is his way of rejecting choosing life, so that he can cope with his shittiness by using heroin. And then when he does the Choose Life thing again, it's his way of like accepting his flaws and deciding to confront his issues to finally be a better person. And I love how when he does the Choose Life thing in this one, I mean, firstly, he updates it for the 21st century. He brings up Snapchat and Instagram and all this other shit. But
Facebook
you
misogyny.
Can see his Yeah, but you can see his frustration for each extra line he says. Like, there's this bitterness towards each choose blank whatever, you know, because it's now reflecting. It starts out as like, yeah, it's just a funny goof gag thing that I did with my friends. But then as he says it more, it's more hateful because it's him frustrated with how, despite trying his best to stay clean, despite trying his best to be the best person he can, he's still taking L's, as the kids say, or whatever. I don't know why I said it like that. His wife is divorcing him. He doesn't have control of his own home. He doesn't have any kids, and you know his business has merged with this bigger company where they don't need him anymore. So they're going to potentially push him out. Like, he's got so much going against him, despite stating in the end of the first film that he wanted to be a better person. He wanted to change. He wanted the cars, the 401k, the 9-to-5, all this other shit. But he's still living this miserable life. You know, it's, yeah, you know what's funny? This is going to be a weird comparison, but he kind of reminds me of Michael from Grand Theft Auto 5.
That's actually a good comparison. Yeah,
because Michael in Grand Theft Auto, okay, I'm gonna spoil Grand Theft Auto 5 in case anyone gives a shit, but
game that came so Michael out 12 years ago.
Okay, yeah, so no one gives a shit about the story of GTA 5. Everyone's doing fucking GTA Online bullshit. No one cares. Yeah, but yeah, so it kind of reminded me of Michael from GTA 5 because Michael kind of goes through his own shtick. You know, he's also this washed up, retired criminal who's always living in the past, who's always very cynical about the American dream, about his prospect as, you know, someone who technically made it, but he's still living this miserable life. His wife hates him, his kids hate him, and the only way he can feel any sort of happiness is when he resorts back to his criminal tendencies, when he starts doing these heists, when he mentors Franklin to be the spitting image of him, to be the new Michael or whatever. And then, you know, obviously Trevor's kind of like Begbie and Sick Boy and Spud to an extent, because Trevor is this ugly reminder of who he used to be in his past and who he used to associate with and the people he had to cut off to find success in his life, to make it big within the American dream. So yeah, he really does remind me a lot of Michael from GTA 5.
Yeah, the choose life thing is so moving to me, because it's like, In the beginning, Choose Life it's presented very sardonically. Like they feel like since they have this heroin addiction, they have kind of a third way almost, where like we don't have to engage with any of this stupid bullshit, like the, you know, rigmarole of society, getting a job, being materialistic, etc., whatever. They have this other thing that they can, that consumes all of their time, and they feel like they're almost enlightened actually by being heroin addicts. But what he's found out is that like he actually did choose life literally, and over the past 20 years, and he still fucking can't find any happiness. Like there's actually no way to be happy. You can be a drug addict that's ignoring all the problems and ignoring everything that society wants people to be, or you can just do all those things, and neither one of them is going to actually make you feel good, which is that's what's so fucking tragic about being an addict, or even really just tragic about fucking existing in society. Like so few people actually get to do what they love and to be happy. You know, most people just have to trudge through the shit, you know, and it's really tragic. But
I think separately from that, y'all both mentioned like a lot of member berries. I can't think of a single like member berry that was like actually egregious in this movie. Like, which is surprising for like a legacy sequel.
I fucking hate all the scenes where they just show footage from the previous movie, and it's just, remember that? Remember when they did the thing in the I fucking hate that shit. I can't stand that shit. Because Matrix Resurrections also did that stupid, annoying bullshit where they're just like, oh, remember, it's like our meeting with an FBI agent, and then they show the scene of Keanu being interrogated by Agent Smith. Remember that? Like, who the fuck needs this shit?
Yeah, like, it's not like they were showing, like dialogue scenes or anything. They were just showing, like, them as younger people.
In this case, Matrix Resurrections, too, which I don't like that movie as much, but It's thematic reinforcement. Like the member berries, it's not like an alien Romulus where it's just like, oh, this, we're literally just showing you this because we know people know about it. It's reinforcing the themes of Trainspotting, which is it's really summed up by Sick Boy when he's like, you're a tourist in your own youth. That's what the movie's about. You know, it's like he basically failed at choosing life, so he's like, all right, I guess I'll come back and see what's going on here. I got nothing else going on, so I might as well just like tiptoe back into that life and see if I can handle it. But
yeah, whenever they flash back to like shots from the original, or whenever he'd like recreate shots from the original and then they cut back in between or intercut them with one another, it never to me felt like remember this. It felt more like the characters, like that's all they think about is their youth at this point. Because like the big theme of this movie is essentially nostalgia, like Nick was saying.
I get that, but I just think that some, like, okay, I'll give you that. Like some does serve that point, and I guess I can't really argue against that. But then there are others where I'm just like, I feel like this is really insulting to my intelligence that you have to show footage for me to just think of the thing that you're actually doing. Like, come on, man. Like, I've seen the previous movie, and like, people who've never seen the original Trainspotting are not going to watch the sequel anyway. So, like, I don't know what the purpose is. Like, the scene where Spud sees people running into like a tunnel, and then just shows footage of him and Mark running away from the same scary bodyguards. I'm like, did you really need to show that? Like, I got what you were going for. Like, come on, like, be a little more respectful of my intelligence and my awareness, man. Like, this is so stupid. I don't like this. This is just a personal preference part. Like, I understand what you guys are saying, and that's totally fine. And to give it some credit, it's not completely worthless. It's not like Matrix Resurrections where they just do that shit for no reason. But it's also just a personal preference where I'm like, I don't need to see footage of the previous movie to get what you're going for in this. It's just something I personally dislike.
I mean, well, did you dislike at the end when Renton tries to appeal to Begbie's humanity by like, Begbie, do you remember when, you know,
teacher, we were boys?
We were boys. They sat me next to you. Because that's kind of just another, it's not necessarily member berries, because that wasn't, you know, there was no depiction of that in the first movie. But that's
yeah, what, like,
the movie reinforces that at every set, like every chance it can, basically, which I like. I think that's what the movie's about. Why not reinforce it? You know, that's my take.
Yeah, I don't have any problems with when they showed flashbacks that wasn't just footage from the previous movie. Like, they just cast random young people to play their younger selves, like when they were teenagers, when they were in their early 20s or whatever. I didn't have any problems with that, because that didn't really feel like a member berry. That just felt like added extra character depth to flesh out these people and not just showing movie footage. I there's like a clear distinction for that for me.
Yeah. I will say the stuff with the son, with Begbie's son or whatever, wasn't necessarily that essential for me. Like, he's already such a shitty person. Like, I feel like that was just like adding to the runtime. Like, it didn't really make much of a change for me.
Well, I think that's supposed to kind of illustrate Begbie's toxic masculinity regarding his paternal figures in his life, because then they show you that scene where he's reading Spud's scribblings or whatever, and they show that scene where, this wasn't in the first movie and it wasn't even like a deleted scene, I'm pretty sure it's in the book though, when they are they're in like an old abandoned train station or something, and they see that guy's like, oh, what are you, train spotting, eh, or whatever. He's like an old drunk, and that was Begbie's relationship with his father, like basically non-existent. He didn't even recognize Begbie as his son. So I guess Begbie's just trying, all he knows how to do is to try to drag his son into a life of crime, because he's so damaged that that's the only version of a relationship he can actually have with his son, is just by trying to get him to like fucking steal flat screen TVs or whatever, which is really sad. But yeah, I mean, the one thing about the second one that I don't like as much is definitely like plottier than the first one. Like,
yeah, definitely more felt of a like narrative. 20 minutes. Yeah. It felt like 20 minutes too long. Like, I'm not sure how to fix it necessarily, but it definitely did feel long.
But I will say I really, really love what the movie's trying to do. I don't have it, like, these are really just me like trying to find nitpicks with it. I think I love Trainspotting 1 and 2. It really does feel like it feels essential to me. It's not like, for example, like the Jesse Pinkman sequel to Breaking Bad, which I liked, but I felt like was kind of
felt like DLC.
Yeah, it felt like
yeah,
DLC.
That
exactly.
was just yeah, it like it had no reason to be a movie. It just could have been another episode of Breaking Bad.
It was like an epilogue made a difference. For Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
This to me yeah. feels like a legacy sequel that had something to say. There is a purpose to it. I even feel like some of the performances are even better in this one than they were in the first one, especially Sick Boy. I think Sick Boy showed a lot more dimension in this one.
We never
they gave Spud way more to do. Clearly,
he yeah, they all got more. You and McGregor got less, but everyone else got more. Yeah,
we never went over ratings for the first movie. What'd y'all rate them?
I gave the first film an 8 out of 10, and then I gave this one a 6 out of 10.
The first one I would go 8.5, and this one 8.5 too. I think I really like them the both about the same. I think maybe the mm-hmm. second one I like the second one. Tugs at me a little more. It means more to me personally. As a movie, I think, you know, obviously the first one is more important as a movie, and it'll go down as clearly the more memorable installment in the Trainspotting saga or whatever the fuck. But to me, like, the second one means a lot, you know.
I'd say I give the first one a 9 out of 10, and then T2 is a 7 out of 10. So they're both really good though. My main takeaway from watching T2 was in its inherent, like, because it's not focusing, like, the themes and focus has changed from, you know, drugs and basically parting yourself away from society, like you were talking about, Nick. And in the second one, it's reintegrating and also just nostalgic for the good old times, quote unquote. And in those good old times, you get all the drug scenes, which were where they're really able to have those incredibly creative sequences. And then the second one, they don't get the opportunity as much, so a lot of the filming and just also the grossness was kind of lacking in the second one. So I don't know, I was kind of missing some of that grunginess for T2, but that's just kind of where I leaned towards my favorite.
That's why the second one is bad. There was no poo poo pee pee.
There was no shit getting thrown into people. Question before who watched? Did anyone watch this with no subtitles?
You can't.
I watched it without subtitles.
I watched it with
oh,
subtitles.
Fuck. Did you know what was going on?
I've watched. I used to like. I went through like a 3-year phase where I pretty much only watched British television.
How do you know what Spud's saying in any scene?
Yeah, especially the scene in the first one where he's on speed and goes to
I've
that
watched,
like employment.
Goes the interview.
Yeah,
I've watched like all of the like British or the UK version of Shameless too. So like.
Fucking, oh, okay.
Hearing Frank Gallagher in that show is like almost impossible at the beginning. But I'd probably give both of them like a 7.5. And I think T2 I like a little bit more, but like I think I'd still probably rate them about the same.
Yeah, yeah. I love when Spud they're asking Spud what's your interest in the leisure industry, and he's like, in the word pleasure. My pleasure is your leisure is my pleasure. Yeah, there's. I mean, I think that the second one had a lot of great set pieces as well. Like the No More Catholic scene is. I watch that on YouTube
that
sometimes.
Funny.
And I honestly, I watch the second Choose Life sequence on YouTube all the time. I really find that very moving. It's a very moving film monologue that I return to all.
Yeah. I listened to. I've been watching the ending to Trainspotting 1 a lot. I really like. The monologue and the music just fits so well. And
yeah.
Bigby screaming, of course, that too.
Yeah. And sprinting towards the camera out of focus. Yeah.
Going back to the first one for a second, the ending is basically as soon as they complete the drug deal, there's just this rising tension. You know, mm-hmm. I obviously I know how it's gonna end, but like it's so well done where you know one of them is gonna fuck over the others. Like it's hinted at a bunch of times. Sick Boy's like, oh, don't run away with it, don't run away with it. And when he gets
yeah,
back,
they keep joking about yeah. one of them doing it.
Yeah.
This movie made me think about something too today. So do y'all have any actors that y'all have just like always kind of just in your mind automatically considered a good actor, but then when you really think about it? Like maybe they're not that good of an actor.
Is that Ewan McGregor for you?
Are you saying Ewan McGregor is that for you?
Well, at first I was thinking maybe Ewan McGregor, which I kind of feel like Ewan McGregor is not that good of an actor. But then I started making me think about other actors, and I was like, I've always thought Tommy Lee Jones is a good actor, but he's not a good actor.
I think it depends on the movie and the paycheck.
He's excellent in No Country.
Yeah, he's great in No Country.
Yeah.
Yeah,
do you have any actors subdued like that?
Like actors that I thought were good and then they're just not that good.
You just in your mind you're like, oh, that's a great actor, but then you like really think about it, you're like, no, they're not.
Well, while you guys think though, you don't
Will
think
Smith?
You don't think Ewan McGregor is good as Obi-Wan? I think he did such a fucking great job. Even though I don't really like those movies, I think he did a great job.
I haven't seen the prequels in a long time, but I remember really liking it. Yeah, but I guess it's just, I only say that because I just purely remember the memes associated with him. Like you said, hello there, and it's over, Anakin. I have the high ground, you know? Like, I just think about the memes more than anything.
I feel like those movies, it's hard to, like, either give actors, like, props or negatives, because I feel like it's so terribly directed and written that it's like,
it's terribly directed. It might not be greatly written, but to say it's terribly directed, I think, is a massive exaggeration.
I think Cosmonaut Variety Hour?
Yeah.
Yeah, he just made a video on like every M. Night Shyamalan video, or every M. Night Shyamalan movie.
That.
And he brought up an idea. He's like, I have a new thing. It's called Swiss Army Knife Actors. If you're able to be in an M. Night Shyamalan movie and give like a genuinely good performance, that means you're a Swiss Army knife actor, because M. Night Shyamalan is really bad at working with actors.
Did y'all watch his daughter's show?
No.
Oh, it's literally one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Oh, what was it called?
I forgot what it's called.
The Servants or something?
No, it had Dakota Fanning in it.
The Watchers? It was a movie.
The Watchers. It was a movie. It was a movie on Netflix.
Yeah, I was going to say, like even a show? I don't fucking remember
it was about fairies,
that shit.
And holy shit, that was one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. Well, like father, like daughter.
Actually, I didn't realize this while I was watching Trap, but when I watched the Red Letter Media episode about it, they were talking about how the pop star. Did you guys see Trap?
No, yeah. But I know the daughter is like his daughter, and she's actually does music.
Yeah,
and she plays
actually.
Yeah, all of the music.
She was actually okay in that movie.
Yeah, but like her
music was fine, but
it was an extended. It was basically an extended commercial for her. If you think
pretty
about
much,
it.
Her
album, she did make an original album for the movie, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. But it's just like it's kind of sick a little bit to be like, are we going to use this movie?
It's like After Earth, like him and Will Smith just can't stop doing it.
yeah. It's yeah. I've heard her music's good. I haven't seen Trap, but I've seen people talk about her acting levels not great, because like I've seen clips where she's just like he's the butcher. Yeah. Your husband is the butcher.
Yeah,
but you never know how much
of
that.
Great. She's not
but like,
great
a lot of
as
that's,
an actor.
A lot of that's
like,
the
her
script,
music
though.
Is...
Like, because nobody really came off good in that
I think
movie.
It's just directing.
Yeah, the directing's bad.
My suit just turned black. I like it, but I think it means something bad.
Well, is it Josh Duhamel? Is that the butcher?
Josh Hartnett.
Josh Duhamel is who you're thinking of.
But he's also just genuinely a really good actor, though.
Yeah, he was good
like,
in it.
And,
what has Josh Hartnett been in?
Fucking, I don't know.
30 Days of Night. Fucking what's the one with fucking Elijah Wood?
The Lord of the Rings. He was Aragorn.
Faculty.
The Faculty. He was great in The Faculty.
Yeah, I've seen the clip from Trap where Josh Hartnett's like, sorry, I just had to get out of there. My friend got burned and it was just. I'm sorry. It was crazy.
He was in that Guy Ritchie movie a while back, and he was really funny in it.
Oh wait,
I just
crazed
into a
ball. Is he in Oppenheimer?
Yeah, he's in Oppenheimer.
Yeah, he did. I think
he
have a small role in Oppenheimer.
Yeah, he was. He was also in Black. He's in a lot of movies that I've not seen but are on my watch list, like Virgin Suicides and Black Hawk Down. But yeah, I cringed and shuddered at the idea that he's in so many Guy Ritchie movies because I think he's a hack. I don't like any movies that
Guy Ritchie's last movie, fucking Ungentlemanly Warfare or whatever. I really liked that movie. Did y'all see it?
I watched his best movies and I felt nothing. I was like, this is all bullshit, but people like this shit for some reason.
Longstock is genuinely a very good movie. If you don't like Longstock...
I haven't seen that, but I saw Snatch and I saw fucking...
But Longstock with fucking Brad Pitt in it is basically what it is.
You gotta watch Sherlock Holmes, too. Those are pretty fun.
The Sherlock Holmes movies are great.
I watched Man from U.N.C.L.E. and I fell asleep halfway through.
I wasn't a huge fan of Man from U.N.C.L.E. I'm not a huge Guy Ritchie.
Get off Trainspot, I wanted to bring up one kind of behind the scenes thing that's pretty interesting.
Sure, yeah.
Because actually, I don't know if you guys know this, but Ewan McGregor and Danny Boyle, basically, they didn't talk from like the year 2000. They had a falling out for a long time. Basically, just because this is a really kind of like shitty narcissistic movie star thing, in my opinion. Ewan McGregor was super mad that Danny Boyle cast Leonardo DiCaprio in The Beach in 2000 instead of Ewan McGregor, and they just literally didn't talk for like 10-15 years, which is why like Danny Boyle wanted to make Trainspotting 2 10 years after the first one, but they weren't able to do it until this because they were able to like wrangle Ewan McGregor back into it.
So actually Ewan McGregor was the Begbie of the situation.
Yeah.
And he was holding all this
I'd like to imagine he dodged a bullet because I'd like to imagine he dodged a bullet though, because I heard the Beach wasn't even that good.
It's The Beach, for some reason, we watched all the time when I was on substitute teacher days in my high school. They'd be like, all right, we can throw on, I don't know.
We have a VH copy of The Beach.
Yeah, I guess
we're going to wheel out the TV tray.
Yeah, look, it's either this or fucking Frozen again, all right? So suck my dick and pick one.
We watched that and Catch Me If You Can. Those were the two movies, movies. I don't know why. But yeah, I just thought that was a dickhead Ewan McGregor
story. One thing, we were talking about this earlier, how much did that, I have the actual inflation numbers. So 4,000 pounds in 1996 now would be 7,878 pounds. So it basically doubled.
Yeah, so it's like a smart amount of money for them to choose for this, because it's like, it's just enough.
It's not that much, like, but it's enough. Yeah.
It would really be, it's like on the fence. It depends on who you're asking, whether that would be enough to ruin your friendship. And obviously you would have to be a sociopath to want to kill your childhood best friend over that, like Begbie, but it's kind of a smart amount that they chose.
It's funny that he also, like in that situation, he got robbed. But because it's Begbie, he didn't like cool off for a second, and then because he was wanted at this time, he probably could have just left there, and he's a sneaky enough character to be able to get around for a while.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have gotten arrested, but he just made such a mess of it and threw a big tantrum essentially that he got arrested like within that day.
Yeah,
all because he wouldn't let go of a grudge of 4,000 pounds.
Yeah,
you know what's one thing that I really did I appreciated about the second one, which I thought showed some restraint, because it's so common in these things to be like, oh, and then Spud went on, like the last scene is Spud at like a book signing or something, and he's
like super corny.
Yeah, he's like, this is my book, Trainspotting, or whatever.
Thought they were gonna do that for a second.
They really avoided that, because at the end, like Simon and Mark are sitting on the couch, like, who's gonna read this? And he's like, I don't know, fucking probably nobody.
No one. Like, maybe his kid might.
Yeah, it was just like a personal thing for him. He got addicted to writing his stories instead of heroin, which is kind of
amazing. I mean, that's what I've heard from other addicts I've known in my own like real life. I'm like, what's the biggest like ability to like cope with, you know, that withdrawal and afterwards? Because the people I've talked to, they're like, it's never like you're done, you're back to normal. It's like you're always thinking about it, and you know, you just do it once and it's just everything falls apart again. So you kind of have to find essentially hobbies and other purposes to fill your life constantly.
Yeah.
Like a guy I know, he's like 6-7 years sober from alcoholism, and he has a new hobby every year. He's like, all right, this year I'm getting really into dirt biking, and then the next year I'm gonna build model rockets.
yeah you gotta occupy yourself. I love Trainspotting too. It really tackles that struggle very beautifully, I think, through Spud and through Mark. I think I would love to see it depicted more, because it's like drug movies most of the time are just like, they're just about the throes of addiction. They're not about the lifelong struggle that happens afterwards, you know, because you're You know, yeah. No matter what you do, like, you're never the same again, you know. I don't necessarily agree with, like, calling people addicts forever, but I mean, it's something that you have to grapple with forever, that's for sure. I just don't like the branding of it for, you know, or how AA does it, for example, where it's like, oh, I'm Nick and I'm an addict. Every time you go there, you have to, like, remind yourself of that, which I don't think is necessarily beneficial, although a lot of people do get something beneficial out of it. So I won't, like, poo-poo that or whatever. But for me, I don't like just saying I'm an addict forever, you know.
What would you say is, like, the best representation of just addiction, like, through drugs in film?
I think it is Trainspotting. Yeah, at least from
what I've heard. Requiem for a Dream is one of those, but I haven't seen that.
I think Requiem for a Dream is pretty good, but it's, like, also a miserable fucking watch.
I've heard that's a depressing one.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I would like to watch it. So if one of you can recommend Requiem for a Dream at some point, that would be great.
I personally think if y'all haven't seen it, Flight with Denzel Washington, that's a pretty good fucking, like, viewpoint on addiction as well.
Is that the one where he's a pilot?
He flips the plane?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the one where he, like, does his barrel roll?
Yeah, he's doused too much in the sauce. I think I tried watching that and I never finished it because I was not interested.
Mr. Washington, you're heading straight for the towers.
I think he does a fucking good job in that movie. And I think they portray his alcoholism pretty well, too.
This isn't flying, it's falling with style.
I definitely think there were some, like, I'm very cool moments, but yeah.
Yeah, I think apparently there's possibility of a third Trainspotting film, apparently, or something, because
I don't know what they do.
Yeah, well, do they just probably wait 20 more years until everyone's, like, fucking 60 or 70 and be like, all right, now it's Trainspotting, but everyone's
damn
a grandpa.
It,
yeah.
I'm gonna get my money, Ren. Come here.
Yeah. This is on Wikipedia, so just kind of take it with a grain of salt, but it said, in March 2017... Danny Boyle discussed the possibility of a third Trainspotting film, suggesting that it could be a spinoff centered on the character of Begbie in a story based on the Irvine Welsh novel The Blade Artist. I think Robert Carlyle would love to do that because it's an interesting twist on the character, Boyle said. They may be made into a film. You couldn't call it T3 because although some of the other characters come into it, they're only featured just momentarily. It's a solo story. You can call that a spinoff. The Blade Artist is a great read. Carlyle was likewise open to an adaptation of The Blade Artist. We've been talking about that. I am up for doing it, he said at the T2 premiere in Edinburgh. So maybe we ain't seen the end of Begbie yet. Boyle stated that he would be more interested in directing a true sequel rather than a spinoff, preferring to work with all of the principal actors. My affection is towards all four of them, Boyle said. People regarded the first movie as being Britton's movie, and I never really saw it like that, though he does dominate because of the voiceover. I always saw it as an ensemble movie, so I'm still very much in that mode. So yeah, apparently they want to make a third one. Fuck it, why not?
I kind of saw envisioned it, at least.
This says T3 is you can't see it, but it says
saw that. I was gonna send that to the group chat.
Still doing heroin 40 years later in a retirement home.
That would
and they're
make
all
for
like got
little...
that aged up filters.
That would make for a cheeky movie, just seeing a bunch of 70, 80 year olds in retirement homes just shooting up heroin. That would be kind of funny. Man. I would like to see that on the big screen. Yeah, so, but yeah, like I said, I think this is my favorite, the first one is my favorite Danny Boyle film, though I still need to see some of his other movies.
Okay. Would you guys say that's pretty much all we have to say? T1 and T2?
Too much else.
I think so.
I looked it up and nothing really is coming out next week. So I think the next on the recommendation wheel would be Tim. So Tim, do you have a recommendation ready for us?
Yep, I've got one, and I'm recommending a movie that I haven't seen before, but it's on my watch list, and I figured, fuck it, why not? I now have a podcast to force me to watch shit now, so whatever, let's do it. I want to do Love and Pop. It's a 1998 film directed by Hideaki Anno, who cheekily made a little thing that I'm a little obsessed with called Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Okay, what's it called, Love and Pop?
Yeah, Love and Pop, 1998. I heard great things about it. Yeah, and I want to. I've
actually
been meaning
looks
to
awesome,
watch it.
So,
yeah.
Oh, I thought it was an anime.
It's not a Chinese cartoon, so I think I'm pretty happy.
That's not what.
Yeah, no, it's not a Chinese cartoon. It is. It's a Chinese live action movie with Taiwanese people.
Got it. Okay. Cool. Well, if you guys enjoyed this episode, please leave us a like on YouTube or leave us a review, a 5-star review if you could, on your podcast listening to platform of choice. And if you want to be ready for next episode, watch Love and Pop, directed by Hideaki Ono. Ono. From 1998, and
I am too Ava Pill to let you just say his last
name
incorrectly.
Well, no, it wasn't me saying it incorrectly. I switched tabs. No, I switched tabs. I knew it was Hideaki, and then I didn't see what it was. I thought it was Ono. Okay, sorry, Hideaki Ono. Then.
I think it would be cultural appropriation for you to say it right, if I'm being honest.
I'm going to do my best to always pronounce the names correctly. I think it's rude to not try.
Hank Andor. You should have just said that. Hank Andor.
All right, boys.
Choose
the right night. Good night, everybody. Oh, get sucked and have a barnyard night.
Fuck. I didn't say barnyard once.
Fuck. Bye.